Well, good morning and welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station. We are the one, 95.1 FM, and of course, for over 50 years, you've heard it before, 1080 on your AM dial. Oh, I see a piece of equipment is no longer in here, so I'm going to go over here and look at this piece of equipment. It is 10:03. Hello, and welcome to the Friday edition, a short edition on KYMN Radio. And I have a guest in studio that's been here. This is his fifth time. And his name is Charlie Coogan. And you were talking about my theme song. And my theme song is Dwayne Eddy and Rebel Rouser. And you said you recognized it from where?
I think that this song is in Forrest Gump. When Forrest Gump is being chased by the kind of tough kids in the neighborhood, and he's walking with Jenny, and then he starts running with his leg braces, and when he breaks them off, then the song comes on.
Oh.
I think so.
Okay. Well, now I'm going to have to find that movie and see if it's in there. You know, I have never met Dwayne Eddy. He's a little bit older than me, but sure was related to him in 1958 when I was a teenager in high school. And this song was popular. The question was, are you related to Dwayne Eddy? I said, yeah, that's my brother. You mean you guys are Dwayne and Wayne? Yep. Well, at Friday morning, let's get started here with Mr. Coogan. He works at Crimson Education, and we're going to talk about what that is all about because it's an international company. And we talked all about his being born in Long Island and moving to Jersey City, then Bayonne, and then Castleton, Vermont, and ended up in Kirksville, Missouri, where he went to high school. And after that, he went on to college. And I think he had a little break, though, between high school and college.
Well, high school and college, I came straight to Carleton.
Okay, Carleton College, all right. And I think I talked about why Carleton College. And just to let people that weren't listening the last time. I asked that, why a kid from Kirksville, Missouri, parents are teachers, why would you come to Northfield, Minnesota?
You know, my mother's family is from Manterville, so if you've ever been to the Hubble House.
I have. I've driven by there many times. I'm 52.
Yeah.
See the big sign?
Right. My grandpa's house was about maybe two blocks away from the Hubble House, and he was a country doctor.
Okay.
And so my mother went to Carleton. By the time my mother was born, my grandpa was living off in Ishpeming, Michigan, up in the Upper Peninsula, and she came back to Carleton. So when I was looking at colleges, I knew about Carleton, and I finally came up as a prospective student instead of just for class reunions, and I really liked it.
Good.
So I ended up here.
And so you got through there in four?
I got through there in four and a little bit.
Okay, and a little bit.
There's a big project you have to do senior year called comprehensives.
Yes.
Comps, yeah. And my committee felt like mine weren't as good as they could be, so they made me redo them.
What year did you get out of Carleton? 60?
No, I got out of Carleton in 82.
I'm sorry.
I was supposed to be out in June, but I did get out in December.
Okay. What did you do on those lengthy vacations? Now, I remember when Carleton went to the day before or so Thanksgiving and a couple of days or the day after New Year's Day, and they did it to save on fuel back then. And it's still in play, even though they have a wind farm now, et cetera. So what did you do for the whole month of December? I mean, did you have buddies that said, God, I wish I went to that school?
You know, when I was playing basketball, we'd stay, and we didn't have anywhere to eat, so we'd actually eat our meals at St. Olaf because Carleton was closed down. And they'd find us a room or two to stay in, and so that was junior year. I studied in Denmark, so it was I didn't come back until the winter term in January. And then senior year, I'm trying to think. I think I actually went home and tried to earn some money.
Money.
Because I realized I was going to be graduating soon, and I didn't have any money to put gas in my car.
Yep. And what kind of car was that?
It was a Maverick.
A Maverick?
Maverick. It wasn't a Mustang. It was a Maverick. A Maverick is sort of like the grandpappy version of a Mustang.
Oh, was it like a Pinto?
Yeah, it was like a pacer.
Okay. But pacer.
It went forward.
Yeah, I had a pacer.
It went forward, and it got good gas mileage.
Amen. And when you opened the hood, you could actually see your feet because it wasn't all full of what they do today with cars. So Jack Dernblad was your coach?
Jack was my coach.
And was he AD at the time also?
You know, I think he might have been.
Okay. So were you good?
You know, I was. Well, you're asking the wrong guy. I thought I was really good, and Jack thought I was okay. So he thought I'd make a very good backup for the starters.
Yeah, but, you know, at 5'2".
Oh, yeah, I know. Because this is radio, I should make the guy. I'm 5'3". Yeah.
No, seriously, you are about 6'1"?
No, I'm about 6 foot tall, but I play now like I'm 5'3".
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, when I was younger, I played like I was, you know, 6'10".
So at 6 feet, did you you were doing basketball when they were in the Midwest Conference.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you were traveling all over the Midwest, and were you like a forward, or were you ball handler, guard?
I was a point guard. Slash shooting guard.
Okay. And were you good?
I was pretty good. I mean, okay. I was. My dad was an All-American basketball player, so I was never that good.
Okay.
But I was a decent athlete and probably not quite as disciplined as you needed to be. And there were some other good players in the team. I guarded somebody when I was playing against Cornell College, and he just tore me up. And I went with my daughter because she was trying out for the soccer team at Cornell College. And so I had about 2 hours free, and I went to their Hall of Fame, and I felt a lot better because that guy is actually in their Hall of Fame.
So
he was twice as good as I was, but he was pretty good.
Okay. What's your most memorable game?
I did make a shot from half court one time, but we didn't get 3 points for those back in the day.
At the buzzer?
Yeah, no, not the buzzer of the first half.
Did it go?
It did go. It went in.
Really?
Yeah, it did.
Did that make the score closer?
Yeah, it actually put us ahead by one, which I'm sure we...
Well, you had to feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, I felt good about that. I was not one of the stars on the team, but I did have fun. And I think it does teach you how to structure your time, because if you're going to basketball practice quite a few hours a day, you really need to use the time that you have free to get some stuff done. And so it did make me, I think, a better student sometimes.
By the way, speaking about students, I'm thinking about responsibilities. And I have a responsibility to memorize a sign that I saw at the quarterback club yesterday when I went in for one of their flame broiled burgers.
Of course.
I got the mushroom one.
Yeah.
And cheese. Boy, they are good. They're really good. And plenty of French fries, you know. And I got some milk, and I think it was like $7 or a little over $7. Anyhow, I saw a sign there that said, "Attention, notice. The quarterback club will open for breakfast at 7 o'clock. From this date to this date," and I don't remember the dates, but it's like coming up or it's going on right now. I don't remember the dates, but just in case, folks, remember if you go there for breakfast before 7, that right now, I don't know why, you know, unless some employees are taking a winter vacation.
I think those biscuits need to cook just a little longer to make sure that they have that extra special flavor.
Oh, yeah, okay. Hey, by the way, I don't know if it was you about talking about donuts at the quarterback club.
No, I think you were mentioning those.
Okay. I did not know that they made them right there.
Yeah.
I was taken aback by that, if it was you or whoever told me that. So yesterday I ordered my burger, and I said, "Give me one of those donuts, will you?" And I had one of their sugar donuts. Boy, are they good.
I bet.
Really good. So, folks, if you want some good donuts and bakery goods for breakfast, they also have those available for you at the QB, locally owned and locally managed. I have all these little notes that I put down, but evidently I didn't put down where we stopped last time, so that's up to you to let me know. And I know who your parents are, and I know
I think we had gotten all the way to Northfield, which is why we were on the home stretch.
Okay. And how did you end up in Northfield?
I ended up coming back because there was a job at Carleton to recruit international students.
There we go, yeah. And that's up on the campus.
Right, right. Oh, that was exciting, because when I was a student here, there were a handful, but not many, and there wasn't a very big international presence.
And now, so you had told Nalong all about Northfield? And
I told her it was Carleton. Just like Chicago.
Okay. Not as windy. And not as many buildings.
Well, I tried to pretend like the churches and the grain elevator were skyscrapers, but it didn't fool her.
And the cannon was an ocean.
No, right. Lake. There's Lake Cannon.
Yeah,
it didn't work. She's no fool.
So what year did you move here?
2000.
And so we're talking 19 almost years ago.
Yeah, 19 years.
And you brought along some children with you at the time?
We brought along two children. There was
John,
our son John.
Rafaela?
John was just going into eighth grade at the old middle school.
Okay.
And Rafaela was 2 years old.
Okay. And then you had another child after that.
Who was born, his name is Pascal, and he was born at Red Wing Hospital.
And there, you had a reason for that?
We were working with Dr. Saul in the OBGYN, and he changed hospitals. He moved from Northfield to Red Wing.
Okay.
And my wife said, we're at 8.5 months here. I'm not going to change doctors in the 8.5 months. So we just followed him and had the baby there.
All right. So where did you, your first home in Northfield?
We lived in a little house right next to campus. If you know where the White Center is.
I do.
Right across the street, there's a kind of a nice cream-colored stucco house.
Well, now what, across Washington or
it's across the street. It's across Third Street. So we were on College and Third, and the house is called Page House. I think there was an old dean back in the early 20th century named Page, and he must have left the college to the or the house to the college.
Okay,
it's a beautiful house, and it can be faculty housing sometimes. Although right now it's been turned into student housing.
Okay,
but we would walk out of our door on Third Street, walk 10 feet, and then be at the middle school.
Wow.
And our son still managed to be late sometimes.
But, isn't that something, yeah? And, of course, you could hear him playing during the day because they took their Phi Ed classes
right
there in Central Park.
Yeah.
All right. So that's your first place. Now, was your goal then to buy a home, and although you had a pretty good deal renting that house?
Well, we did get a good deal, and the idea of getting a good deal is it gives you a little time to save your money.
Yeah.
And so we got 3.5 years there, and then the person in charge of the housing started sort of saying, so you guys probably saved up some money by now. When are you going to move out? Because we've got new faculty coming in, and they'd love to have a place like this. And so we started looking, and it turned out near the college, we love the houses, but they're too expensive. You know, my wife was back in nursing school at that point at St. Kate's. And so it was just my salary. And so we looked at places close to the college, and it wasn't so affordable. So we ended up getting a place on Sibley Drive, way out by Sibley School.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Brett Reese one day because he found out where we were moving. And he said when he was a little kid, he and his dad would walk down that way because I think his family might have been involved in developing some of that area. And they were planting trees. And his dad would say, you know, Brett, one of these days those trees are going to be big trees and they're going to give beautiful shade. So when he came and saw how big the trees were, he was pretty happy. He said,
well, it's interesting that you say that because I had two good friends, one really good friend who lives in Denver now. And when they bought those houses on Sibley Drive, they had what they called Sibley Swale.
Right.
And was a real big deal because it was nature.
Right.
And one guy told me, he said that the salesperson said, you know, look out at your backyard. That's what you're going to have is a beautiful field of corn or soybeans, and that's your view, and it's going to be nature and all that. Well, you go out there today, and it's got five more blocks all this housing out there.
Right.
And it is a beautiful sight. And you mentioned the trees. That is interesting to go out and check those out because as a kid, you think, you know, you don't ever think you'll live longer in a tree or bigger than. And I used to live on the end of 6th Street, and I had two trees in the front yard. They're still there.
Right.
And it's fun to see that change. And Sibley is all nice, dry, shaded area when you drive through.
And there's so many nice paths you can walk behind by Sibley Swale. There are paths up and around. And we got a dog about 5 years ago, and that it's only when we got the dog that I started checking out those trails, but it's really beautiful back there.
Did you, what year would that have been?
When we
moved us.
We moved there in 2004.
Okay, I was going to ask because I wonder what the interest rates were in 2004 before the housing bust in 2008.
You know, the interest rates, I think, were not perfect for us, but of course we were getting our first house, so I think we might have had about 6.9%.
which is pretty good compared to what it
compared to what it was at some points.
Yeah.
And the college used to have a program that doesn't exist anymore, where if you were coming in on a national hire, so you came in from out of town, they would help you to get your first house. The idea was you want to get a community in Northfield so that when students are, you know, walking down the street, they walk through their professor's yard and things like that. So we did get a little bit of help from a program that existed at that time, but I think that one's been discontinued.
It is 18 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair. My guest this morning, number 5 interview with Charles Cogan. And we are going to take a brief break, and we'll be back in a flash with more information and get on to the new job that this gentleman has and see if we can figure it out.
Monster Jam, where it's winner takes all. No guts, no glory. Witness the best of the best. See Gravedigger, Max D, Megalodon, and more of your favorite Monster Jam trucks. This is Monster Jam. Presented by official partners America's Best Contacts and Eyeglasses, BKT Tires, and Metro by T-Mobile. Tickets on sale now. Experience adrenaline-charged family entertainment. Lock in your seats today at MonsterJam.com. Coming to U.S. Bank Stadium February 16th.
Don't let a dead battery leave you stranded this winter. When a warning light comes on, it may already be too late. Visit Witt Brothers Service, your Napa Auto Care Center, for a free battery check, and make sure your battery is up to the challenge of a Minnesota winter. Need a replacement? Witt Brothers can make it easier on your wallet with a $25 Visa gift card by mail with the purchase of a Napa Legend or Napa Premium battery. Visit Witt Brothers Service at 701 Division Street in downtown Northfield for full details.
The van, the yellow van. Service Master.
Service Master by Iatt congratulates Aurora Pharmaceutical on being named the Northfield Area Chamber of Commerce Business of the Year. And also Chris Canelli, who was selected Business Person of the Year. Congratulations from Service Master by Iatt. Remember, whether it's carpet or upholstery cleaning or fire or flood restoration,
the man, the yellow man, called Service Master.
Service Master by Iatt, 877-945-0993.
Well, hello, Beth, the president and CEO of Service Master here in Northfield. Always do a nice job with my carpets. Once again, our guest this morning on the Wayne Eddy Affair, parents number 5, Charles Cogan. We finally got him in Northfield. Now he's got he and his family have their own home over on Sibley Avenue, and you're working for Carleton College, and you're working to develop a little international participation in the population of the students at Carleton College.
Sure.
Is diversity the main reason?
You know, I think it's diversity, but it's also that students learn from each other. It's a small college, so it's a community. Within the community, if you have people from different backgrounds, you just learn from each other.
Well, you know, what about a job like yours where you know, you think of a teacher as a teacher and a professor as a professor, interaction with students. But here you're recruiting. You're on the campus in an office over there. Can you get involved with students at all?
We could. The admissions office is pretty connected because you have hundreds of visitors every week. And so we have a whole student staff who worked with the tours and would help set up information sessions. We have students working on different projects. You know, they're pretty smart kids, so you can often give them the kinds of responsibilities that really help. And I think one of the things that Steve Lewis used to say when he was the president, he said that every staff member at the college is really a teacher, because if there's somebody working in the admissions office mentoring a student, teaching them how to be effective in doing a job, you know, it's all kind of a teaching. So in a way, it was kind of nice. I think he, and I know the other faculty and presidents have that feeling, too. That
so these students that they're showing, a prospective student to campus, et cetera,
right,
is that kind of like the football players and the cheerleaders trying to recruit a great athlete at a big university?
I hope not.
No parties or anything, huh?
No, well, I can't vouch for that. One of the things we're not supposed to be doing is hanging out on campus at 10 o'clock at night at a party.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly, you know, how that works. But I know that in general, this is more daytime stuff. And there were hosts for students. So, for example, if you have 100 students come in that have all been admitted and they're trying to see where they're going to enroll, one of the things they need to learn about is what is it like to actually be a student on campus. And so they'd stay overnight. They'd go off to classes the next day. And so, it can, you know, give them at least a chance to be a student on campus for a day and see what it feels like. And so I think there's a whole range of stuff going on. Sometimes the students are pretty active in organizing panels. So maybe there's a panel that says, you know, if you're a student on campus, what's it like? What kinds of things do you do? And the parents and the students can come and ask questions. And one of the questions might be, what's party life like on campus? And usually that wouldn't be the students asking, but it would be the parents trying to figure out what their kids are going to be getting into. And I think it's better to have students on those panels as well so that they can give you a pretty good sense of what it really is like to be a student. Otherwise, you get me, Pat, talking, and I would probably answer to the best of my ability. But I think, you know, integrating the students in all of these things tends to make them a better experience for the visitors.
Well, we all know that when you recruit an athlete and he's sought after by many colleges or universities, we're talking, I know you can't recruit athletes.
You're talking about University of Minnesota.
Yeah, things like that. Sure. If you land that individual, it's a big deal, can make the newspaper and all that. So my impression from you so far is that you're recruiting, and you tell me about that student that you got that other colleges wanted, because obviously if they go on and become very successful, there'll be alumni that will help support the college.
Right.
I mean, look the long range.
Right.
But do you ever, like, land a student and high-five somebody and say, hey, we got so-and-so with a 4.9 grade average?
You know, I think there is some of that, but I think also you want the students to get a place that really fits them, too. So I think during the years that I worked at the college, I did often feel some pride when a student would choose Carleton above other schools, but I always wanted to make sure they were doing it for the right reasons, because if you lure them in and then it turns out it wasn't the right school for them, you know, you haven't done them a big favor. But because I'm an alum, I kind of feel like it's the best school for everybody. So I think I could honestly try to convey that to students.
Now, is there an individual that had the similar job on the St. Olaf campus?
Yeah, there's Jenny Hauenstein,
okay,
who is actually wonderful. Yeah.
So you two are did you two ever have a fun conversation saying, hey, student B is looking at both of us?
Right, right.
And
no, we I don't think we did that as much, but there was somebody before Jenny named Luyen Phan. And between the two of them, they've done a great, I mean, they've built the program at St. Olaf to be a really strong program over the last 20 years. I think Carleton and St. Olaf both had pretty minimal international presence when I first came, and I would say both colleges are really thriving, and it's a mix of students.
You know, I just wonder if you had a little fun, like you'd meet each other at the Hideaway or
No, we used to meet Rubenstein. Each other at the laundromat because both of us had broken dryers.
Oh.
So that's where I think I first met Jenny. We were both waiting for our clothes to dry, and we started talking. I thought, oh, wow. And we do have annual breakfast together with Carleton and St. Olaf admission staffs. At the end of the year, once you've got your class, or once you think you've got your class, we'd all get together and have breakfast and sort of say, okay, good, let's get geared
really?
Up.
Really?
Yeah, it was nice. I think there's some good, you know, there's a big project called Building the Bridge, trying to increase the relationship between the two colleges, and I think it's moved in a positive way.
And
I know alumni from the 1950s wouldn't believe it, but.
Well, they actually can take classes on each other's campus?
You can do that,
yeah.
And there are some courses that are taught by faculty back and forth, you know, where students at both colleges could enroll. We work together on internet stuff just because you wanted to bring in the broadband and all of that. I think, you know, when you think about it, in Boston you've got 100 colleges and universities, and that's a strength. So here you have this little town of 20,000, and you have two really top-notch liberal arts colleges. If you don't work together, it seems like you're wasting an opportunity. And I know the presidents at the two colleges have worked really hard on that and have built some good relationships.
By the way, it's 20,007.
20,007, and then we have a new census coming up soon. It might be 50,000.
Oh, boy. So you do work together. Now, what about your social life? I know you're a Rotarian.
Right.
And what did you and your family do once you got your own home on the east side on Sibley and you're working with the college? So now you're part of Northfield. When did you start believing and feeling like you were a townie? And are you there yet?
Well, I probably delude myself into thinking I'm a townie, and I've never been invited. Apparently the measure of a townie is that you get invited to serve on the local volunteer fire department. And nobody's
well,
ever
that's a pretty tight
Nobody's ever mentioned that to me, so I think I'm not a townie. I've never gotten the Joseph Lee Hayward Award, so
okay.
I would say I'm a long time from being accepted as a townie, but I feel like a townie. How's that? I feel like this is my town.
Okay.
And I feel like there are lots of good friends and relationships in Northfield. And my family's been coming to Northfield for college for 140 years. So I think there's a lot that binds us to this town. But, Northfield is also a part of the bigger world. And so it's kind of neat that you have this very strong sense of community. And this community has its tentacles out there in the world as well with people who've spent formative parts of their lives in Northfield doing really exciting things around the globe.
So what did your kids do? What did your wife do? And what did you do? As, like I said, you were a Rotarian, but
right.
What other things did you get involved in outside of the college community?
Our son John came when he was in eighth grade, and he played some sports in eighth grade, but in high school, it turned out that the high school was going through one of those periods where they had one of the best soccer teams in the state. For 3 years, they got number two. They lost either Totino Grace or Benilde St. Margaret's. Three years in a row. I know. And I mean, a few bad calls and things like that, but yeah. What the heck? But it wasn't just him, but he was a good player on those teams for 3 years. And I think there was Ben Danielson who coached the first year.
Yeah.
Then Ben took off and headed up to St. Paul Academy to coach the girls teams. And Jorge Zuccolotto took over. And Jorge is, of course, a great coach and has been doing some coaching at St. Olaf as well. But he led them to some more conference championships, but then, second in the state is strong. I know they felt like the Buffalo Bills a little bit at one point where they kept on getting second.
Jim Kelly.
But they beat, great teams along the way, and it was pretty exciting. The teams kept on being good for several years after that as well. So he graduated and went off and played soccer in college. But the Northfield teams are still, they're still very strong. So.
Now, what did your son do? What college did John, you're talking
about?
Yeah,
John. Right? He started out at Waldorf College.
Waldorf in Iowa.
Yeah, they had a good program. He has a little bit of, what do they call it, ADHD? And so they were able to work with a really good structured program.
ADHD.
I think it's an attention deficit thing. And it made it, he needed a little more structure to do well in the classroom. And so they had a good program. And he went there and he played soccer for them, and they got a brand new coach who brought them up so well that the coach got hired off by an even bigger place. But I think they were really having fun with the soccer, but I think he also got a good academic foundation there. And then he spent a couple of years at Augsburg as well.
Okay. You remind me, back in the 50s when I was in high school, they sent me and I would say eight other students to a special class in a different building.
Right.
And all of us thought we were special.
Right, you were.
And when I reflect on it now, I think we all had what they call now ADHD.
Right.
When you're studying, chemistry and Latin and things like that, you got to pay attention.
Right. And our son John, his senior year, was doing a class with, I think, Sam Wold, who was one of the history teachers, or might have been an education class, but he actually did a study and he found out that the modern high schools teach to about three or four different learning styles, but there are about 15 learning styles out there. And so basically, if you don't fit into those three learning styles, then you either need a different structure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and in Northfield, you do have Arcadia, as well. And, at the elementary school, you've got Prairie Creek, but you've also got the public school. So I think
St. Dominic's.
Yeah, St. Dominic's. So I think you do have a lot of choices in town. And I suppose the key is finding the school that really fits your learning styles.
I was thinking, as being a teacher, since we're on that subject, the demands that there's equity within the education system, how difficult it must be to have, let's say you have 25 students, which is a heavy load.
Right.
And let's say 15 of them are really, a third of those are good learners and another third are, better learners. And you had really good learners, but it's the other ones that are not learning well and they have to teach to them.
My dad used to teach at a state university and he went to an Ivy League university to get his PhD. But his undergraduate degree was at a state university, too. And he always said, the good students, you can work with them and push them further. But they're going to succeed one way or the other. There are some students who aren't motivated. Some of them you may be able to lure in and get them motivated, and they'll do better. But there are a lot of students right in that middle range. And he said those were the students where you could make a big difference if you taught well. Because if you got those kind of middle range students who had maybe the beginnings of some motivation, but they didn't have the confidence, and you could bring them in and really start to work with them, you could see those students shoot right up. And he said, even the students who weren't motivated, maybe they just hadn't found a subject they loved. And so, you know, my father was teaching physical education, which for a lot of students might seem like something that they could connect with. So I think a good educator will try to find a way to reach all three groups, but it's not always easy.
I have to ask you, there's an old saying that when I went to radio school about, if you think should I or shouldn't I, don't.
Yeah.
Good, but I'm going to break that rule. What's so tough about physical education? The body is built a certain way. You're either strong or whatever. Now, I can see a sergeant in the Marines shaping up a group of people that
right.
never thought they could get where they got. But in Phi Ed in college, is that a choice? Or are they teaching how to coach? What you know,
well, yeah,
a PhD in Phi Ed?
Right, right. Yeah, my dad loved it because he was an old jock. He had been a good athlete in college. He went off to Korea and he worked in a prisoner of war camp. And his job was to run the training programs. And so he did sports, he did arts and crafts, he did things like that. And he saw that it really made a difference for the Korean prisoners of war, who thought that they were going to be put to death once they were captured by the Americans. And he realized that you can have a big impact on people by giving them some structure, some athletic, and, you know, things to keep them healthy. But also, and so he actually came back with a whole different perspective on it. And he decided that he thought that mind-body relationship, that the psychology of sports, you know, how do you get a positive attitude? How do you develop a winning attitude? Sociology of sports, how can sports help immigrants, for example, to get integrated into a community? So let's say you come from a country where people play a lot of soccer and you move into a town. Maybe there's your way to get a lot of friends and all of a sudden you become a part of the community. You know, so there are things like that. So I think he felt that on so many different levels, that the physical activity was a part of yourself, and that if you could really focus on how your brain and your body work together, you can become a better athlete. So he trained a lot of coaches over the years, and I think he felt those coaches were all mentors too in their own way. So I think for him, he felt that this was his way to give back. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm expressing it well. I never studied physical education to get a doctorate, but I did watch him work with people over the years, and there were people when he passed away who came to his funeral who said, you know, I ended up being an automobile mechanic, but I learned so much from your dad that helped me to be a better mechanic. You know, so I'm not a coach. Well, actually, a lot of them were coaches. They just had jobs in the community, but then they did the coaching because they loved the coaching. So I think, in a way, you can touch people's lives in almost any job you can think of, right?
Okay, and so, but you'd also teach the rules and regulations of basketball and football,
right,
and
right,
soccer,
right,
and all of the...
He'd come to my high school and teach fencing.
Fencing.
And some of us loved that because we'd been reading The Three Musketeers and things like that, or watching movies. I think there was a Three Musketeers movie with Raquel Welch that we watched, probably to see Raquel Welch.
Yeah.
But then we saw people fencing, you know, sword fighting. And so he came and taught us how to sword fight. That's something you'd never get in high school. And I remember coming to Carleton, and I was a good enough fencer that I didn't get destroyed. I wasn't good enough to win.
They had
a fencing team? There were some people coming from the East Coast, right?
Yeah.
These, I won't say fancy prep schools, but maybe they were having access to sports that we weren't having.
Yeah.
And when I got into the fencing club, I could at least kind of hang in there and hold my own. I would never defeat one of the really good fencers.
Is there a word when you succeed?
Touché. Like, touché.
Touché?
Means you touch somebody.
Yeah.
Okay. You're not trying to cut them in pieces, although there are different kinds of swords.
Touché means like I you got me.
Yeah, you got me. Touché.
Who says touché? The winner
loser? The person who got touched never wants to say it because they're just hoping you didn't notice.
Touché. Okay.
Yeah, it's like touché. You
know? Okay.
But what often it also means, I think, is you have to touch swords before you start fighting, a little bit like a karate person would bow. So in fencing, you touch swords to kind of say, yeah, we're both ready. And then touche, you touch swords, and then you get going.
I was really disappointed when I saw that one of the first swords, they have a little ball on the end, don't they?
Yeah, they do, because you don't really want to be.
Yeah. And I went, well, this ain't real. They don't even have a tip on it, you know. But that's when I was a kid.
You lose a lot of soldiers in practice if you're using live swords.
Yes, so, I suppose you do.
Just like if you were doing a practice battle and you have live bullets.
So how long did you have that position at Carleton?
For 17, a little over 17
wow,
years.
Wow, yeah, 17 years. That's a long time.
It meant a lot to me because when I was a student at Carleton, there weren't many international students. And I feel like international students are sort of a neat group because they really value the education. It's been such a big ordeal to even get through the process to come to the United States that when they get here, they're not going to take it lightly. So you found really highly motivated students. And you're in a global classroom. You know, when I was a student, we'd all study abroad. I think Carleton and St. Olaf both send more than 70% of their students to study abroad during the 4 years. But then you'd come back, and if you go to the French table, you'd have the professors and, you know, maybe a couple of decent French students, and then everybody would do their best. All of a sudden, you know, I'd go back to the French table in 2012, and there would be a student from Senegal, which is part of West Africa. I didn't even know that Senegal existed when I was at Carleton, but it's a French-speaking country. The first president of Senegal wrote a book saying, I went all the way to France and taught the French students, and they weren't my best students. And he was teaching French there. So, I mean, Senghor. So there are all these really cool things. And you go to the German table, you've got a few German-speaking students from around the world. I think it just kind of brings that home. You're teaching Chinese politics or Chinese economics, and you've got three or four Chinese students in the room. The discussions are better because they've learned something from one direction. The professor knows both directions. The other students, the American students, don't really have a sense, but you get this kind of a discussion and an engagement that you would never get if it was just all American students in the classroom. So I think we learn from each other, and I wasn't a big part of it, but I was a little part, and I'm pretty proud of the efforts that the college has put into that over the years.
Did you ever have any students that were the product of a dictator or a country that wasn't favorable to the U.S. And you know, learn here and go back there and take advantage of what he learned here?
I would say yes, but I would say that our goal wasn't to train the people who are going to overthrow dictators. That wasn't it. It was just to get students a really good education and a base and a sense of civic engagement that would serve them well when they go home to try to maybe make the country better. And there are a lot of students who've gone back. I mean, I only worked there for 17 years, but a lot of those students are now getting to be in their late 30s, early 40s. Maybe they're going to start bringing their kids, but I won't be there anymore to say hi to them, but I might get them for a cup of coffee while they're in town. And a lot of them have gone on and done really, really good things.
Well, one of the things celebrated was Hollywood children, and one of the monkeys went to Carleton College. I don't know if he finished.
Yeah, Peter Tork.
Yeah, and
I'm not sure he finished. I think he was pretty busy being a monkey.
Yeah, and his
making big money, so he took some time off, I think.
And I heard on KYMN radio, I think Scott Peterson did it, I'm not sure, interviewed him.
Right.
And, of course, it was nostalgia for him.
Right.
Okay, and then I'm trying to read the wife of the Croc, the McDonald's guy.
Yeah.
Had a connection to Carleton, I believe.
Right.
Did you know her?
I didn't know her, but I'm not surprised. I mean, this is okay. A good college, and what I think is nice in the Midwest is that there are some parts of the country where it gets pretty competitive. So if you're a UCLA graduate, maybe you're not going to be friendly with a Berkeley graduate or something. I think in Minnesota, we're not too full of ourselves. And so I think that, you know, for example, I was just on in my job yesterday. I'm assigning a tutor to work with a student. And the tutor's at Columbia University in New York. So we joked a little bit back and forth. And then she said, oh, and by the way, my mother and my grandmother both went to St. Olaf, and I hope that doesn't bug you. And I said, not at all.
Okay.
It's great. I mean, it's pretty amazing that you have a Northfield connection.
Well, the Johnnies and the Tommies, they can have
a that's
bit.
A whole different story. Yeah.
We're going to take a brief break. We'll be back and continue our conversation, learning what it's like to bring students from foreign countries to Northfield, Minnesota, by way of Carleton College.
Welcome home to Northfield Manor. On the campus of Northfield Retirement Community, Northfield Manor is proud to offer HUD Section 8 subsidized equal opportunity housing for adults 62 and older. Take advantage of all amenities on campus, including our state-of-the-art theater, Imelda's Marketplace, Fitness Center, Main Street Cafe, walking trails, and more. Call today, 507-650-7332. Northfield Retirement Community. Innovation. Choice. Tradition.
Northfield Construction Company has provided quality general contracting services to the Northfield community for over 45 years. Our experienced and diverse team can handle projects from the smallest home remodel to a large-scale commercial project. Whatever your construction need, Northfield Construction will deliver. Call us today about your next project, 507-645-8000. 8975.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair at 18 minutes before 11 o'clock on KYMN Radio out of Northfield, Minnesota, the home of Cowles Colleges and Contentment and Carleton and St. Olaf. And our guest this morning is a former employee from Carleton College, and he is now working for Crimson Education, recruiting foreign students. Question, can you name people that went to Carleton that you know of and knew that are like the prodigies of famous parents?
Well, I had a professor when I was at Carleton who was pretty demanding. His name was Owen Jenkins, and his wife Barb is still a good friend. She's a heck of a tennis player, too. But I remember that when I came back in 2000, I saw Owen and we chatted, and he said, "Charlie, you were a pretty good student, but you were never as brilliant as Jackie Orr." So it made me, and she was big in the theater community at Carleton. So it made me curious. So I went on the alumni directory, and now she's a journalism professor at Syracuse University and doing some really neat things. But yeah, there are a lot of classmates who've gone on.
Was she the daughter of Bobby?
No, I doubt it. I mean, she might have been. She might have been, but I don't think so.
But you don't know of any...
There's... when I was in Singapore one time, one of the people I was working with at the Public Service Commission, which is a body that gives scholarships to Singaporean students to study in the United States, and so we wanted to get to know them so that if they had brilliant students interested in a liberal arts college, we'd be on their radar screen. And she said something about her favorite show being The Frasier Show.
Oh, yeah.
And so
excellent show.
And, of course, I had something in the back of my mind, so I said, you know, one of my classmates actually was the executive producer of The Frasier Show.
Oh.
Bob Daly.
Okay.
And then he used to work with Rugrats, and she said, oh, when I was a kid, that was my favorite show. And then later he was working with Desperate Housewives.
Oh, I like that show.
So she said, you know, I'm going to put Carleton on my list. You know, I think that if you're producing really cool people like this, then, you know, I should definitely be keeping Carleton on the radar screen for some of my creative writing students. And I said, yeah, but we're strong in the sciences, too. So I think any admissions person has to have a kind of a Rolodex of people who've done really well who've gone to their college. And you have one for different occasions. You know, there was a classmate who came and gave the commencement speech a couple of years ago and got an honorary doctorate named Kathy Hudson. And I think at one point she was the deputy director of the NHI. National Institute of Health, or NIH. So, I mean, there were 500 people in my class, but when we come back for reunions, I'm always amazed at the things that they're doing.
Do you ever feel kind of like below, you know, sometimes people go to their high school reunions or college, and they don't feel like they've accomplished enough to walk in with their chest puffed up. And then there are people that walk around and say, well, look at me.
Yeah, I would say what I like is that the people who've done incredible things tend to be pretty humble about it. So I have a friend who owns a company that does mortgage industry analytics, and they have an entire floor in a skyscraper in New York City. But if you ran into him, you would never know it. I mean, that's not the way he relates. He's just happy to see you, and you'll see him sitting with classmates, and you might find out, you know, from someone else the cool things he's done, but that wouldn't be what he leads with. So I've liked that. Maybe that Minnesota humility sinks in and makes everybody a little bit easier to deal with.
But there's no doubt about it. Name dropping in networking is important.
Right.
And if they can make a connection, for example.
Right.
Like that lady you were talking about just now. So I was hoping you'd drop some names that I could say, oh, I've heard of them. Now, I've heard of the shows that this fella wrote or produced.
Right.
I never heard of
them. Do you ever watch the Colbert Report?
Who?
Colbert.
I can't stand
Stephen Colbert. I know. And you can blame a Carleton grad for writing all of his bad jokes, right?
I can't believe it.
His name's Peter Gwynn, but I think he's moved on to another show now. But I'm just saying that, you know, there are people out there who you know, from every college. And so I know St. Olaf has got a whole rack of incredibly successful people. But, you know, when you think about it, you go to a place like Minnesota, you end up with this kind of an ability to be down to earth, but it doesn't mean you're not sharp. And so I think there are people who go on and do really well, partly because they're not ruffling feathers as they go.
So what happens now? You do international.
Right.
And you're doing it for a for-profit company now.
Right, right.
But even when you were at Carleton College, the last several days here in Minnesota has been publicized internationally.
Right.
And, oh my God, Minnesota, 50 below zero, Thief River Falls, International Falls, and Minneapolis and St. Paul at 45 below, wind chill factor 90 below. And it's being pumped out all over the place.
Yeah.
How does that affect your recruiting effort?
Well, I think it sort of narrows it down to a certain kind of person who thinks, wow, that's a challenge. I'm gonna look for that challenge. But I think that there is no question. When I first came to Carlton in 2000, I was leaving the Rotary Club of Evanston Lighthouse in Evanston. And there was a really nice guy in the Evanston Lighthouse Rotary Club named Charlie Seiler, who had been he's a polio survivor. So he'd been one of those little kids who sat on FDR's lap when they were trying to raise money for polio.
March of Dimes.
Right, right. And he had gone on to become a big ad executive. And he said, Charlie, you're a bright guy, and I know you're going to work hard at this job at Carlton, but I just can't help feeling badly like you're wasting your career, because I can't see you convincing a person to leave Paris to go to Northfield, Minnesota, or to leave Moscow even to go to Northfield, Minnesota, or to leave Uzbekistan to go to Northfield, Minnesota, because it's not going to have the draw of a big city like Chicago. And so I feel like you're wasting your talent. And I thought that was nice of him to say that, but this is a pretty magical place too. So I think that what happens is when students have come and realize the kind of attention they're getting from faculty and the kind of opportunities they have we had one student from Malaysia learn to play the guitar when he was here, you know, and then he ended up going on and becoming an investment banker, but now he went back and got his PhD and is teaching. But he said, you know, where I'm from, you have to be good already by the time you're my age. You don't start when you're my age. And so I think the kind of unexpected opportunities that students have often make a huge difference. And now he can serenade his wife because he just got married.
Okay, so did you answer my question?
The weather is not our best friend. But I can remember about 10 years ago, there was a day when we were having our admitted student days in early April. And if there are any people from the admissions office listening, some of my best friends on earth, they'll remember that day, because we brought all these incredible students to campus, and they were just the best students ever, right? We admitted them. We'd worked so hard to get them admitted. They showed up on campus, and as they drove into town on the bus, it started snowing, and I think it snowed about 3 feet.
That was 1991?
Oh, no, this is maybe 2008 or 2010. Okay. It's somewhere in that range. And I think our first reaction was, oh, my gosh, we've done all this work, and now the weather is going to destroy our harvest. These students are never going to enroll. But what happened is they found spaces on campus to hang out, and they may have connected more because of the weather. So even in the admissions office, you had students sitting around playing cards and talking, and in a way that maybe if they were all dispersed all over the campus, they'd have had a different experience. But, you know, a lot of them came, and they said, yeah, we didn't love the weather, but we loved the people we ran into. And sometimes what you'll find is when the weather's bad, you do spend quality time because you're not running off to your next thing. You know, it's like, I could wait another half hour. And so who knows? But I would say we don't value the weather as our biggest buddy, but because people in Minnesota do know how to live with the weather, when people come to us, we try to keep them safe from the weather and take good care of them. And maybe they at least go away thinking, okay, cold hands, warm heart.
I was on the St. Thomas University campus, or it was St. Thomas College, way back in the late 50s. And it was really interesting. When they built some buildings, they didn't put in any sidewalks. And they allowed students to walk on the grass and all that. And then they realized the paths that they were taking. And then they laid their sidewalks there.
Right.
And they also had underground heating. Does Carlton have any piping that goes through campus and it melts the snow?
Here's what I would say. If you want to get the inside scoop on that, you know the guy to ask. That's Fred Rogers.
Okay.
Fred Rogers, he's Mr. Infrastructure. So,
okay.
But when I was a student, we used to have underground tunnels.
Yeah.
And we used to walk around, and that's where the heating pipes were.
Right.
I think there was also a little bit of asbestos down there, so maybe it's good that they're closed. But so those are still there. But the college right now is in the middle of doing a massive infrastructure upgrade to do geothermal energy. And so there's going to be a lot of stuff underground that's going to be heating the campus. But I don't know exactly how all that works.
Okay.
But Fred's one of the people who worked with the engineers to help design it, so I bet he would have some So he's done a presentation or two that I've sat in on.
Uh-huh.
But if you want an expert, I know he
would. Yeah. Maybe Keith Covey knows more about it, too.
Keith Covey is pretty sharp, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
He was the director of the physical plant at Carlton. Right. And then he was the mayor when I came back in 2000.
He's one of the first person I met when I came to Northfield. You know what his job was?
What was his job?
Handling and managing the Northfield Area Chamber of Commerce.
That's got to be a thankless job.
And his office was located above what would now be like Hogan Brothers or Hideaway.
Sure.
Above what at that time was a hardware store.
Right.
And that was his job. And he was our mayor on two occasions.
Right.
And just a very nice guy. I've had him on the air.
You know, Keith and his wife also became...
Judy.
Very, very... Yeah, Judy became very good friends with one of our international students before Carlton did much that way. There was a Rotary exchange student named Wizzy from South Africa. And she made a great impression on people when she was in town.
Wizzy.
Well, if you want to hear about a famous Carlton grad, she ended up going back and becoming the editor of Oprah Magazine in South Africa. And, you know, Oprah has done so much work with a new school that she founded and everything. So, and then Wizzy is a filmmaker, and she brought back some of her films for a presentation about 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's some great stuff there. Yeah. So I think here's this kind of a serendipitous thing where I think Keith Covey and Judy were a couple of the champions who said, we really should find a way for this student to get an education in Northfield, and she did.
Yep, Wizzy, I'll never forget her. I'm glad you brought her up.
Yeah.
But speaking about Judy, my story that Judy told me, I never forget, and I tell other people the story, and that's the chapel story and where to put the front door.
Right.
And they had it facing the bald spot in campus, and the president's wife at that time said, no, make the door right on 2nd Street so that people know it's open to them.
Right.
I'll never forget her telling me that story.
And when we're done today, there's going to be a really good convocation at Carlton. They do one every Friday, and it's for African American History Month, but I think he's a really good speaker. And I'm actually looking forward. I told my wife to go too, but that's something, we're not at Carlton anymore, but it's open to the public, so we're going to walk right in.
I've often thought I really wish I had a super good connection to both colleges, and when they bring in speakers,
right,
you know, see if they could cut out the 9 to 11 section.
Yeah.
So they could come on the show and talk about what they're going to talk about or talk about what they talked about. It'd be really cool if they could do that.
From the time that we started these interviews, you know, a few weeks ago now, I've been reading a book by one of the convocation speakers called The Warmth of Other Suns about the great migration from the south of the United States up to the north. And I didn't know that book existed until that convocation. And it was such a great convocation that she presented that I actually bought the book and I've been working my way through it.
How is it?
It's good. It's a great book.
I mean, is that... when they went from Montgomery, Alabama to Detroit, Michigan?
Well, you know, during World War I, apparently there was a real labor shortage because so many men were off in the wars. And so you had Rosie the Riveter and things like that. But you also
had... That was Second World War.
Yeah, that's Second World. But you had some people stepping in to fill those jobs, but you still couldn't keep the production at the levels you needed.
Yeah.
And so recruiters would go down to the South and go into African-American communities and say, you know, we need laborers up in the North for these factories. And the South needed that labor in the South, too. So there were ways that the kind of Jim Crow South tried to undercut those recruiters, thinking, you know, we need these people working in the fields. But it turned out it was an opportunity, and I think it was never easy, and there are a lot of challenges. I mean, there were race riots and all kinds of other terrible things, but the end result was that, you know, three generations of people moved to the North, and a lot of them did things they'd never have done otherwise.
You just used the phrase Jim Crow. And I'm going to take this final break, and then we'll only have a couple minutes. And you tell us, that's me and listeners, how you interpret the use of Jim Crow. Okay?
Sure.
We'll be right back.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Hi, I'm Kathy Olson. Navigating the unfamiliar land of senior care can be daunting. We're here for you. Millstream Commons offers the care and services you need and the independence you want. Renting one of our assisted living apartments provides you with three meals a day, served restaurant style in our dining room, weekly housekeeping, and the option of adding personal supportive services as you need them. Our staff's on duty 24/7 to provide that much needed peace of mind. If you're searching for options, give me a call. I'm here for you.
Three Links in Northfield congratulates Aurora Pharmaceutical on being named the Northfield Area Chamber of Commerce Business of the Year. Chris Canelli, who was selected Business Person of the Year, and Lynn Ziegler, the Chamber Ambassador of the Year. Congratulations from all of us at Three Links in Northfield.
A Friday morning, the first day of January, and the year is 2019, 2.5 minutes before it's 11 o'clock. And my guest this morning is Charlie Coogan, his fifth appearance on the Wayne Eddy Affair. And before we took that brief break on KYMN, Northfield, Minnesota, I asked him to interpret the use of the name Jim Crow.
And you did a good job to ask me that question, and all I can say is, in my answer, you should realize that there are people who teach things like this at the two colleges. So, for example, Harry Williams could sit down and give you a three-hour, very articulate answer that would have much more value than my little attempt, but I'll do what I can. If you look at the life of Adelbert Ames, do you remember Adelbert Ames? He was a famous Northfielder.
Oh, the Ames Mill.
Right, the Ames Mill. Yeah. You know, he was a Civil War general who actually showed a lot of courage in battle. And if you ever read the book, Jesse James, The Last Rebel of the Civil War, there's a whole section on Adelbert Ames was the governor of Reconstruction, Mississippi.
Right.
And he worked like crazy to make this mission of giving equal rights to black Southerners a reality. And he tried, and there were black senators, there were black representatives. There was a real effort on this. And the people who had been in power, you know, basically the white South, really resented him and began to undermine him. And it became very difficult because there was the Ku Klux Klan had, you know, come out in numbers. And it was really, really tough. So then you've got that situation. He ended up in Northfield, Minnesota, and played a role in the state of Minnesota as well. But by the time he left Mississippi, a lot of his efforts had been undermined and weakened, and you had a new administration coming in, and suddenly it was no longer, you know, right after the war. I mean, you had Andrew Johnson, you know, serving after Lincoln was assassinated. Then you had this whole period where a succession of Republican presidents tried to hold this together. There probably were some abuses as well. You know, the South would talk about carpetbaggers who came down and maybe weren't always working in the best interests of everybody. And that's where...
Well, Ames would have been a carpetbagger.
Well, yeah, he would have been considered a carpetbagger by any means. But I think the bottom line is that the hopes that came out of the end of the Civil War and the, you know, all of the great proclamations didn't bear the kind of fruit in the long run that they could have. And then a lot of it was rolled back. And then in the late 19th century, a lot of laws were put in that were put in a little bit like when I was a student at Carleton, the United States was criticizing South Africa a lot and saying, you know, apartheid is bad and you need to get rid of it. And the South Africans sometimes get kind of pissed off and say, where do you think we learned it from? We copied what you did with, you know, blacks in the South, with Native Americans, you know, putting them on reservations in the West. You know, a lot of that stuff that we learned from you, and now you're coming back and saying it's bad. This is the topic for much smarter people than me to talk about for hours. But I would say Jim Crow was the attempt of the traditional powers in the South to keep freed slaves from having access to the same kinds of opportunities that others had. And also it created conflict between... It was a very strange thing. You saw it in the cities in the North, too, where sometimes the wealthy weren't in the trenches having these conflicts. It was the people struggling to make a living from different groups that ended up in the trenches. There was a race riot in the Civil War, and it was Irish who had just arrived and were really struggling to get by and felt that the influx of blacks from the South would make it really hard for them to succeed because it would be cheaper labor and things like that. So an economist would say it goes back to labor. Jim Crow was an attempt to keep the labor of Southern blacks undervalued.
And the Chinese at the time?
Well, in California, yeah. You did the same thing, right? Yeah. You had the Chinese being forced into a situation where their labor could be undervalued, yeah. too. So it's a...
So Jim Crow is not a person. It's just a name used to show that you're trying to keep people down.
Keep people down, right.
So what about Jim Beam? You got to keep that down, don't you?
Well, I never could. You know, I've never been good with hard liquor. I could never keep Jim Beam down. Usually about two shots and it was right
How
back
about
up.
Jack Daniels? You know him?
No, it's a good, you know, they're
Johnny Walker, do you know him?
You know, I visited Kentucky because a good friend of mine was a graduate student at Peabody at Vanderbilt University's musician. He's gone on to become a great musician. Friend from Kirksville. And we went and had a tour of the old Shaker colonies.
Uh-huh.
And while we were there, this man basically got mad at us because he saw that we were having a beer. And he said, "Why would you drink what we give to our hogs down here? If you want something good, you have to distill it further, and then you get all the impurities out." And then he was making a plug for Jim Beam and Jack Daniels. So.
Speaking about making a plug, I'm making a plug now. Introduce me to some of these people on Carleton campus, like the fellow you mentioned could do 5 hours on Jim Crow.
Right.
Network with me and connect me, and let's get some of these people to sit there and continue our education.
Yeah, we all learn, don't we?
Yeah.
I've learned from reading this book.
Yep. Well, I thank you very much for joining me all these times, and I wish you luck with Crimson Education. I foresee in the future an opportunity for you to come in and concentrate on just what you're doing today and where you're going and what is the flight like and all the expenses involved to be an international traveler. How many languages can you actually communicate in? How many languages you just kind of know to be able to go to the right bathroom and to the right train? Will you do that?
Sure.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Our guest this morning on KYMN Radio, Charlie Cogan, and that was number 5. And you are listening to the 1080, that's 95.1, excuse me. You're listening to KYMN, Northfield, Minnesota, 1080 on your dial for more than 50 years. And, of course, now.
95.1.
The 1.